history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that really need to be heard, and we don't want you to miss out. If we take the time to ask a few questions and listen, you never know what we're going to learn. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, coming to you from Hillmar, California, where there's a pretty proud football tradition. They love their yellow jackets here, and I saw a yellow jacket grandpa seat cushion for the football games here. Maybe we'll hear a little bit about that before we're done from Joe Harden, 92 years old, soon to be 93, and a veteran from the 24th Infantry Division in World War II. But let's go way back, Joe, because I know you remember. You grew up in Marin County, north of San Francisco. What was that childhood like in the late 20s and through the 30s?
I had a real good life. I went to parochial school, graduated from grammar school in San Anselmo, St. Anselmo School. I only had 1 year of high school. I went in the service, maritime service. But Marin County was beautiful and had some of the best water in the world. I don't know if they still have it, but it was nice. Even a little later on when I worked for Bell System there, they tested the water, and it was pure enough to use in batteries.
Well, and I'm just thinking, putting myself in your shoes, if I'm a kid and I'm in Marin County on the north side of the Golden Gate, and then all of a sudden they're building a bridge to San Francisco, that must have been an exciting deal, because you were there as a kid when they built the Golden Gate, right?
I was with the first groups that walked the bridge before they opened it. The baker in town, his son and I, he took us down there, his son and I, and we walked across the bridge, but you had to walk back to get home. But, yeah, I seen the bridge while it was being built at different times. It was quite a thing to see. It's a beautiful bridge. I don't think there's another one in the world quite like it.
Well, I'm just imagining, as a kid, that must have seemed really big and adventurous and, I mean, amazing that they could build a bridge like that where there hadn't been anything before.
Yes, we walked across the bridge, and we had a lot of fun walking across and looking over how far it was down to the water, you know. But the only thing we could do was spit and see where we never could see it hit the water, though. But it was beautiful. And then they had the World's Fair with it, you know. I went to that. The two of us, we'd go over to stay all night, go sleep in where they had the animals. I had a wonderful childhood. I really did. Well, one of the things over there that we had a lot of fun watching was they had a dirigible up. And then these guys went out there when they dropped the baseballs and caught them. That was something to watch. But they had everything at that World's Fair. It was wonderful.
Well, speaking of baseball, if you go to San Francisco now, all you see everywhere is Giants, 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 Giants. But when you're a kid, they're still in New York. There weren't any major league teams in any of the sports in San Francisco. Were you into sports at all? Were you a ball player or anything?
I only had 1 year of high school, and I went out for track, and then I was going to go out for football. But the war came along, and we were gung-ho. We had to go.
Well, let's talk about that, because everybody I've ever interviewed for this show remembers something about December 7th, 1941. You were just a few days away from your birthday, just a few days past your birthday. You turned 16 on December 4th, and then 3 days later this happens. What do you remember about that day?
Well, all of us wanted to go in the service. We wanted to go fight because they attacked us. But I wasn't old enough, so I ended up, I worked in the shipyard for a little while, and then when I got old enough, I went in the maritime service. At that time, it was, I don't think it was considered the armed services. Later on, they did make it part of the armed services. And I was in that until I was old enough, had to register for the draft. And I wanted to go from the maritime service because I had a Class C deferment for the war, but I wanted to go into the Navy. But I requested induction and ended up in the Army.
Funny how things work. And I'm curious, too. I mean, we talked about growing up there and seeing the bridge being built and the World's Fair. And I think sometimes we look back and we forget what it was like at a time and forget what didn't happen, even though there was a concern it might. And where I'm going with this is Pearl Harbor happens, they've hit Hawaii, but there is a real concern, from what I understand, that they would hit the West Coast. And what better target than San Francisco in the Bay Area if you're going to hit the West Coast? Do you remember what those days and weeks and maybe even months following Pearl Harbor were like in the Bay Area?
Yeah, about that time rationing came out, you know. When I was 15 and a half, I got a driver's license, but because I was part-time delivering groceries, but I also had to deliver coal in 100-pound sacks. I had done that till I was old enough to get into the maritime service, and then I went over to Australia there, came back, and then I went coastwise with the Standard Oil. I was on the Cape San Antonio going to Australia, and then when I got back, I went with Standard Oil, MV Cape San Antonio, and went up coastwise tanker.
Well, and even before that, so right after Pearl Harbor, do you remember blackouts where you guys had to turn your lights out at night because the Japanese might be trying to bomb where you lived?
Oh, yeah, we had, they put blinds on the windows, so you could have light inside the house if you had your blinds right, you know, but you couldn't show no light.
Was that a little unnerving to think, hey, we could get hit by the Japanese right here?
Not for me as a kid. No, it didn't bother me. I imagine it did bother a lot of people, but we were just so anxious, you know. If they came, we wanted to fight them.
Yeah.
We didn't know if we could do anything, but we were willing. You know?
You mentioned joining the Merchant Marines and going around on these ships. You go to Australia and then up and down the west coast of the U.S. What kind of ships were these and what were your jobs on those ships?
Well, at first I went out as a mess cook. That was the quickest way to get through the school. I went to school on Catalina Island, Avalon. You know, they took over this recreation things over there and trained us. First ship I went out on was a naval ammunition supply. We weren't allowed to go in convoy. I went to Australia, Brisbane, and Sydney, and then I came back, and I wanted to go into the Navy, but they said I had to go through my draft board because I'd turned 18. At that time, they didn't need anybody in the Navy, so I ended up in the Army.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would have made sense for you to go to the Navy. You've had all this experience aboard ship already. Did the danger of what you're doing ever strike you? Because, I mean, if you look at the losses from the Merchant Marines in World War II, it's staggering. And you're talking about being on an ammunition ship. You know what's going to happen if they hit that.
Well, when we went aboard, the steward took us up to sign articles. And they gave us a camp cot if we wanted to sleep on deck because we were going over into the tropics. And they gave us a life jacket. And we were walking back the hole where they were loading. Of course, we didn't know it was an ammunition ship at the time. They don't tell you this thing. And one of the fellas looked down in there, and he said, they shouldn't have given us life jackets. We need parachutes. I'll never forget that. It was something, and I learned a lot there.
And I'm sure most people got that line, but if they didn't read between the lines, it means you would have been blown sky high, and you need to float down on the parachute.
Yeah. Well, they wouldn't let us go in convoy because if something hit the ship and it blew up, it could have sunk other ships just by the amount of explosives they were on it.
Well, and were you aware of how many merchant ships were being hit by enemy submarines, whether it were Japanese, German, or otherwise?
Oh, yeah. We learned all about that, you know, but the Pacific, I don't think, was as bad as the Atlantic. They had some real problems over there. But we just went by ourselves and zigzag all the way over. They never stayed on one course very long so that no submarine could get a real good fix on them.
I know it wasn't a terribly long time, but it was long enough. Did you run into any storms that made you wonder if that ship was going to stay together?
Well, we were in one storm, and one of the deck guys was in the crow's nest, and he didn't get out quick enough, so he had to come down, and green water came over the bow, hit him and knocked him down, and that took, we lost one deckhand, so one of the people from the black gang, he took his place. I was a mess cook, so I went down in the black gang and become a wiper.
And when you say the black gang, some people may not know what that means, but it has to do with what's going to end up all over your body if you work in the engine room?
Yes, a wiper in the engine room, you clean oil. We had generators, six generators. Two were working, two were in reserve, and two were being overhauled constantly. That's the way it worked. The wiper is what you done is you help the people working on the engine wipe down the parts, clean the parts, and you were constantly working in oil. So that's where they got their name. You took your shower every night, though.
You must have taken to the sea life if you wanted to go from that into the Navy. Did you enjoy that time on ship?
Yeah, it was fun for me, but it was a lot of hard work, too. But I enjoyed it. Went to Australia, and we were 28 days in Sydney because their wharfies, they call them, could only operate one winch, where our longshoremen operated two winches. So when they brought something out, the guy could operate both winches. He knew how to bring it up and then with the other winch, pull it out over the dock and drop it down. But over there, that was their regulation. And they dropped a pallet of 5-inch 38 shells over the side. We stayed 28 days in Sydney, Australia, waiting for the divers to get the last of the shells up because they couldn't move the ship. I had a good time in Australia. We had rationing in this country, but nothing like those people did over there. Everything was rationed in Australia, even your clothes, even towels. People thought they had it tough in this country, but nothing like they did over there. And the people that I talked to there, they didn't get any fish. They living right on the ocean. All the fish went to the army.
Well, and I'm sure you'd get even more perspective when you end up fighting in the Philippines. But you turn 18, you go to the draft board, you're hoping you're going to end up in the Navy, but that's not what happened. How did that unfold?
I told them that I'm supposed to go in the Navy, and they told me that the Navy doesn't need anybody right now. So all of us went into the Army except two, and those two went in the Marine Corps.
Did you have any apprehension, concern, anxiety about going overseas to go into combat in the infantry?
Well, you have a feeling about it, but we wanted to go. Because we were really, well, the Marine Corps would say we were gung-ho because we wanted to go over there and because they attacked us. We wanted to be after them. And so it gave us a better outlook about it.
What was waiting for you when you got there? Tell me about your first experience with the 24th Infantry Division.
We went in on Leyte. They put us in the 34th Infantry. I ended up in A Company. That's the 1st Battalion. And I ended up in 1st Platoon. First squad, and the first few days I was the second scout, but after that they made me first scout. Now, you don't know what you're doing, really, but the sergeant told me you'll learn fast.
Was he right?
He was right, yeah. It's not a lot of fun. You can be really scared.
Well, I want to hear about that, and I know some of it's not easy to talk about, and I don't want to pressure you, but I want to understand, and I want our listeners to understand what it was really like. So here you are. You're still a kid. You're still a teenager, and you talk about being first scout. Can you help people understand what that means, how much is riding on that, and how much danger you're in when you're the first scout?
Well, they call it now in the service walking point. You're the first man. The squad's strung out behind you. You're looking for the enemy, and everybody's following you, so you have a little bit of responsibility. I don't know how other people felt, but when I was scared, I had a hard time walking. I could jump pretty good, and I could run pretty good. It was hard to walk. I've got a poem, and I'll try to get you a copy of it. You can read that. You might see something in it.
Well, you say, you know, when you were scared, it was hard to walk, but easier to jump or run. Were you scared going into it, or were there things that happened that made it real for you to the point where you felt that fear?
Well, if you're not meeting any resistance, it's not too bad. But when you start seeing the other side and what he's capable of doing to you, you know. So that's when you get really uptight.
Well, and how does that happen? I mean, do you have a bullet whizzing past your ear? Is there a grenade coming in? Are you seeing guys behind you that get hit? How do you know that the enemy's there?
Where we were going up on Mindanao, we went through a lot of places, abaca. And abaca is it's a type of banana tree that they make Manila hemp rope out of for landing hawsers for ships. And it's thick. You have to zigzag going through it. Well, when you meet an enemy, if you're in that, it's almost hand-to-hand. Most of the time, we tried to stick to the roads. We had the roads during the day. The enemy had them at night. We would put in a perimeter on the road, dig in, and if they were retreating at night, they were in trouble. But anything that moved at night, we killed a lot of caribou, a lot of pigs.
Well, and you talk about that at night. What's that like trying to sleep in those conditions, knowing what might be out there and what might be coming your way?
Well, when you sleep, you can reach your hand and touch the guy on either side of you. So every other one of you, one sleeps, and you wake up the next guy, make sure he's awake. You take turns sleeping. It's not too bad until something happens that they find you or they try to sneak up on you at night. We had some bad experiences at night. Well, one time when we were dug in with B Company, it was one of them on the ground and one of them went up a tree with an Ambu machine gun, 25 caliber machine gun. The guy on the ground fired a shot and then he went behind the tree, and when some of B Company's guys start shooting from the foxhole, the guy in the trees shot down into them. And you didn't want to throw a grenade, you know, too close, but you wanted to throw grenades before you ever fired out of the foxhole, because they could see that muzzle flash, but they couldn't see the grenade when you threw it.
So they baited some of those guys into firing by firing a first shot, and then when they saw the muzzle flashes, the guy in the tree picked them all off?
Right, they did it that way.
And this is what wakes you up or makes you aware to the situation that's going on, as you hear and see all this going on?
Well, at night, every other man is on watch. You stare out there, even a little bit of breeze blows a leaf of one of those abaca trees. You see it moving. You can almost swear it's somebody out there, but then we'd have had them crawl right up and stand up looking for us, you know, 10 or 15 feet away from you. They'd crawl up, and you couldn't see them, you know. They'd be on the ground so close in the low grass, and that used to happen once in a while. Somebody would stand up maybe 15, 20 feet away from you, start looking around.
So what do you do if you figure that out?
Pull a pin on a 3-second grenade and throw it.
And hope you're on target and he doesn't move?
Well, you don't have to get right on them, you know. Any place within 10 or 15 feet away, you got him. Unless there was a lot of people coming in at night on you, then you didn't want to fire. If there's a lot of people coming in, you had to fire. But we built up a berm in front of us, and we're sitting down in the foxhole. I always carried a Thompson submachine gun. They took my M1 away from us when we first landed and gave me a beat-up old machine gun. So it wasn't much of a weapon. Fine at close range, but not at long range. An M1 was a regular infantry rifle, which was, as far as I'm concerned, the best infantry rifle ever made.
But they give you the Thompson submachine gun because they know you're going to be fighting at close quarters?
Your scouts carry machine guns because when you come in to where, you know, you're going to be surprised when you see them. It's not like you're sitting someplace where you can look off and fire at them at 100 yards, no.
It's time for our first break, but you heard Mr. Hardin mention the poem he wrote. If you head over to the Hometown Heroes radio page on Facebook or hometownheroesradio.com, you'll find a video of him reading that poem. There are some photos there you might find interesting as well, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I've found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 92-year-old Joe Hardin of Hillmar, California. As a first scout serving on the Philippine islands of Leyte and Mindanao with the 24th Infantry Division in World War II, I'm sure you're not going to be surprised to hear that he experienced some close calls.
We were advancing with tanks at one time, and there was a bar ditch coming into the side. They stopped the tanks. Well, when you advance with tanks, let me tell you, you have to go up a road with tanks over there because, you know, the jungle is soft, the tank will bog down. So you go up a road. Well, when you advance with tanks, your two scouts are out ahead of the tank. Sound funny? You have two infantrymen on each side of the tank, the rest of the squad's in back. Your squad leader is talking to the guys in the tank. They have a phone on the back. But that's the way you advance with tanks. We stopped with a tank at one time, and there was a bar ditch, and I stepped up in the bar ditch, leaning against the side, and a bullet ricocheted off the road. And I didn't know where somebody was that was shooting at me, but I figured they were shooting someplace in my direction. And another shot hit the road. I was leaning close to the bank, and I heard the noise on the when he jacked another shell into the chamber. That soldier was in the same trench I was in. It was a drainage trench, you know, coming down. But he had two shots at me, and he never hit me either time. And their rifle was a bolt action, and they had a mud guard, and that mud guard was made out of a heavy sheet tin, and it made a clank-clank noise when they jacked another shell in. And that's the way I heard him, because I didn't know where the bullet came from.
So are you insinuating that then once you knew where he was, you were able to neutralize that threat?
Well, I jumped up, fired back at him, and got the heck out of there. I didn't know if I got him or not. I never went up there to find out. But I got down onto the road, and I couldn't see up that trench line because of the rise off the road.
How far away do you think he was?
75, 80 yards. He wasn't a very good shot.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because the first thing I noticed when I walked into your home here in Hillmar was a beautiful buck on the wall. I didn't count the points.
Three-pointer. But that deer was in Vell early in the season.
Well, I know that's not the only deer that you've caught. There's a lamp behind you that's made out of antlers, and I know you lived in Alaska for a while where you could practically live on the deer. So my point is, if you were sizing up a deer from 75 or 80 yards, what would be the likelihood that that deer would be dropped?
When I hunted in Alaska, the first deer I shot in Alaska, I shot running, and I hit him through the shoulders. I knew right then that going through the shoulders, you ruin meat. All the time I was in Alaska, which was about 4 years, I never shot another deer through the shoulders. I shot every deer through the head. It was up there, we'd sit, watch, and when a deer come out, he had to be on the high side of the road. If he's on the low side of the road, we'd never shoot him. If he's on the high side of the road, you wait till he got down fairly close. Take your time. I still have that rifle.
Well, and so what you're telling us is that you're a pretty good shot, and if you were standing 75 or 80 yards away, you probably wouldn't have missed. So how fortunate were you that that enemy soldier didn't hit you in that scenario?
I often wonder. Either he was scared or I don't know how he acted in when you see an enemy. I know how I acted, but when I was advancing, I carried a Thompson submachine gun. And I had two clips, 20 rounds apiece, taped together so I could fire 20 rounds, turn the clip over, shove it in, fire 20 more rounds. But altogether, I carried 19 clips, 20 rounds apiece. I carried a little ammunition, but I never wanted to run out.
Well, understandably so. And I'm sure that's not the only close call that you experienced over that. That's one that you shared about. Are there some other instances that you look back on, you say, boy, how did I get out of that?
Well, I wrote a little poem about one day as a scout. I fired at the side of a building as I seen the muzzle of a rifle around the corner, just the muzzle of the rifle sticking up. And I knew somebody was there. The first few rounds with the Thompson submachine gun wouldn't make it through corrugated iron. You know, the corrugation like they put on the sides of buildings or the roofs. But after one clip, well, I punched some holes in it. Then when I moved ahead, I went ahead about 45, 50 feet, and I needed a drink of water. So I sat down, and I was in kunai grass, which was about 3 foot tall. And across the kunai grass, not 50 feet was the edge of the abaca, and one of the enemy stepped out of the abaca and was standing there looking around. I fired at him, got my drink, put my canteen back, got ready to move, looked up, and there was another one standing there looking down at the one that I'd shot at before. I fired at him, and they sent the guy that was second scout up to me because the squad leader, the company commander, asked what the hell was happening up there because they couldn't see where I was at. The squad leader told him he didn't know it was his scout that was out there. And about that time, they opened up on the center of our column with a 50 caliber, their 50 caliber type machine gun, and we had to withdraw. What we run into was there were too many of them. We're just our group, so we pulled back.
What does that feel like in those moments? How much adrenaline starts pumping through you when you're taking a break for a sip of water and you look up and see a guy who could kill you if you're not fast enough?
Well, I couldn't walk. I was so tight, you know, my muscles were so tight. I could make some quick steps, jump, and run, but walking slow was awful hard. Fear is, you can't really explain it until you're under that yourself. But for me, my muscles just tightened up. To walk was just, I could jump and run, but I couldn't walk.
Well, and did that ever change? Is it something you ever got used to, or was it like that the whole time you were over there in combat?
No, I was just scouting, I could, you know, move along slow. But once that you knew there was somebody there, then the fear builds up in you so much that it just your muscles are tight. With me, anyway. I know some of the guys that were with me, they could fire an M1 pretty well. I never had to worry about, you know, really taking a bead on somebody, because with a Thompson submachine gun, you don't really use the sights. You point and fire.
Well, and you just described for us a couple instances where you came really close to being wounded or killed in action. I'm just imagining that for the amount of time you spent over there and the situations you found yourself in, you did have to deal with guys around you getting hit. How hard was that to see a guy that you've trained with, served with, fought with, be killed or wounded in action?
Well, it was pretty hard. We had one group, it was a double squad. A guy, his first name was Richard, the squad leader on that other squad. We called him Big Dick. He's a big, tall kid. And they got into it bad, and him and two other guys, I can't think of one of them's name. I know one of them was Billy Ireland. He was from Mill Valley. One of the fellas in his squad was his next-door neighbor, and they were buddies in Mill Valley. His buddy got hit. He was trying to help him, but the kid was bleeding to death. Classen was his name, and he was crying for his mother, which most men do if they're wounded and they feel they're going to go. And then Billy Ireland was, we got them out of there, but then Billy Ireland was never the same after that. His buddy, he wasn't in my squad, he was in his second squad. It's hard. We had one medic, his last name was Ratto. He was wounded. He was still running on his ankle, helping the wounded guys. You can't imagine the fear. You're scared. I don't know what really being brave is, because I was scared all the time.
Did you ever find anything that helped with that? If you see these guys get hit one day and you know you're going right back into the same thing tomorrow, how do you keep believing that that's not going to happen to you?
You're just hoping and praying it doesn't. Although there was some fellas in my outfit that had been in there a long time, and they grew callous and they wanted to get wounded, not killed, but they would have liked to got wounded so they could get out.
That's how horrible it was to be living that reality day after day.
Yeah, it's not fun. Not fun at all.
Did you have any sense of what you guys were accomplishing while you were there?
Well, it's we know we were winning because we were pushing them and pushing them. On Mindanao, we pushed them clean up into an area where there was some primitive people that lived in that area, and they didn't really want us to go in there. They were afraid we'd pass some simple disease on them that would kill them. But we just went and pushed and pushed. And of course, a lot of the Japanese lived after the war, hidden out on those islands, didn't even know the war was over.
Well, how did you know the war was over? What do you remember about that?
We had pulled back. We were down near the road, supposedly their highway, that run along the coast. And they sent six of us out on a bridge guard on this road. We had pulled back down from combat. We drove them up there so far. There was six of us on this bridge guard, and we knew the direction where our company battalion was at. And in the middle of the night, we seen tracers flying up, and we thought the company got hit. The next thing we knew, this Jeep was coming down the road with the lights on, and we thought it was guys trying to escape. And they came up, stopped, and told us the war was over. But we stayed there. We had to stay there on that bridge anyway, because we didn't know if the Japanese realized it was over, and they didn't. But we pulled back and went back onto the beach, reassembled, and the Filipino guerrillas went in and tried to get the Japanese to come back out. Some of them, I'm afraid, the Filipinos, their home guard or whatever they were, the Japanese treated some of their people pretty bad, and they treated some of the Japanese pretty bad, too.
For you, I know this wasn't the end of your experience, and there's some other real interesting things we need to get into, but after being in harm's way so much for so long, was it a relief to hear that Japan has surrendered and this war's over?
Oh, yeah. It was a real relief, yeah. But, you know, combat, it's hard to explain, because with me, I was always scared. You know, when we were in combat, I was always scared. So consequently, when it was over, I was relieved, but we knew it was over. But the Japanese on that island, most of them didn't know. They were back. We'd driven them back into the jungles in the wild country. So when we pulled back, we left that to the Filipinos.
Well, what you're saying is that could have been a dangerous job, because they don't know or believe that it's over. So what's to stop them from taking a shot at you?
Oh, yeah, because a lot of the Japanese, it was months and months they had to get them off some of those islands, because they didn't know it was over on Mindanao. That's a big island. And then back in the center part of that island, they got some wild people.
But you had another landing to make. The war's over. Japan surrendered. But they sent you guys where?
We landed Shikoku Matsuyama. We made a combat landing there. But when we landed, S1 sent a Jeep in, because we knew where we had to go, or they knew where we had to go. And they sent an S1 Jeep ahead of us. They were reconnaissance, and I was in the second Jeep, and I had one fellow with me on a machine gun mounted with a windshield down. We got kind of off the track, but we found our way back, and we went up to where the company was going to move in the morning. It was an airfield when we were going to bivouac there. We found the other Jeep. We had sleeping bags, and we went in and found the barracks, but we laid down in the barracks. In about 15 minutes, we got back up and got out of there, slept in the Jeep. The barracks were full of fleas. We couldn't even use our sleeping bags. We didn't know what was biting us, but something was biting us. But the next day, the company moved in, and we set up squad tents on the airfield. It was a training airfield for the Japanese Army. But the people were gone. And when the women did come out of the hills, they were wearing, I think they called them booties, but they were like long knickers down to their ankles. They didn't wear kimonos and obis. They wore those because they could run. They were scared of what the American soldiers were going to do to them. But we didn't.
Well, what did you guys do, and how long were you over there?
I don't remember how long I was in Japan. I guess about 18 months, something like that, before I got out of there. I had transferred into the motor pool. I ended up as a T4, which is a sergeant. I was a sergeant over the motor pool. Had a good job. We had that Japanese guy you saw the picture of. They sent him to us so he could help us. When we were working on Jeeps and everything, we'd take them apart. We had these Japanese guys would clean up the parts, and we'd inspect them and put things back together new, you know, or repair, because we had to bring all our vehicles up to, you know, they were in good shape, because we chased all over Japan when we first got there. We'd take Jeeps and convoy and go out, and we spiked their coastal guns. You know what that means? We take a thermite grenade and shove it down the barrel, throw it down the barrel of their coastal guns, and it gets so hot it melts the mechanism on the inside, and you can't open the breech to put a shell in it. It just melts the steel. It bonds together. We had to do that, and then we go around and take inventory of warehouses. They'd come and collect all their arms. They loaded their rifles and everything, and it stacks of rifles, just big piles of rifles. Some of them as big as a house, and they'd just take them down to the beach, load them on landing craft, take them out to the Japanese trench. That's deep water out there. I guess it's 3 or 4 miles, maybe it's deep, and dump all that stuff in the ocean.
There was something else he saw in Japan that very few people saw the way he did, and we'll hear about that when we come back. Imagine a 19-year-old driving into the blast zone at Hiroshima. He'll tell us what it was like when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our chat today with 92-year-old Joe Hardin of Hillmar, California, originally from Marin County, north of San Francisco. We heard early on how he saw the Golden Gate Bridge under construction and actually walked across it before it was open to vehicles. Another historic sight he witnessed in 1945 was not as pleasant. I do want to warn you that some of what we're going to hear is pretty gruesome and certainly not stuff you hear every day, so I'll let you use your own discernment as we work our way toward the scene at Hiroshima after the atomic bomb was dropped.
The Jeep I had was, when I went into the motor pool, it was number 11. It was supernumerary. You know what that means? If any other Jeep is out of service, you take over the job. Like if the colonel's Jeep goes out of service, you drive for the colonel. If the S1 needs a Jeep, you just flit around from one job to the next. Right. Well, we tore all over those islands going and finding these arms and stuff so they could start getting rid of them. Stars and Stripes, they brought in a reporter and a photographer. They wanted to go in where the atomic bomb dropped, and we went in. I drove the Jeep. They took pictures. We went into a hospital. There was a Japanese policeman that could speak a little English. The hospital walls were plastered just like they were in any hospital in this country. It was that white plaster. But when you looked at the buildings, and these were the only buildings that were standing. The rest of the buildings were blown flat because their buildings over there are made out of wood and paper. And there's blood splattered all over those walls. They couldn't figure out, you know, what happened, how the blood splatter all over. And the shards, they got it from this policeman, the shards of glass blew and hit the people in the hospital and just tore them to pieces. And their blood blew all over. And we went to a bridge that went over this little river right by where that dome target was at. And it had concrete sides. It was concrete curved bridge, and the sides were laying out, and they thought with the blast hitting that bridge blew the sides out, and the policeman told them, no, it was people trying to run away from the fire, so many people pushing, they pushed the sides out on that bridge. It was hard to believe, but I drove them in there. They took a lot of pictures, and guy wrote down a lot of stuff, and then went. I took them back. Well, a photographer and a reporter from Stars and Stripes, which was the Army newspaper.
Well, and those photos would go around the world and all kinds of people would see them, and it was what made that atomic bomb real to them, the power of it, the magnitude of it, the destructive ability of it. But you saw it before they did, before those pictures were published. What was that like? I mean, you're a 19-year-old kid seeing all this.
Well, the thing that really got me was 99% of the town was flat. There was nothing there but kind of reddish dirt. But the Japanese were already planting gardens. Over there, everybody has a garden, you know. But there wasn't too many people in the town. But we'd pass little plots of ground where you could see things were growing in lines, so you knew somebody planted it. I wondered if that soil wasn't radioactive, and eating that might have caused some damage to those people. I don't, but I never knew.
That was my other question. I know you didn't spend a ton of time there, but have you ever had that thought yourself? Hey, was I exposed to some radio?
I've thought of that a couple of times because we didn't know. I didn't know. I just had that number 11 Jeep and supernumerary, that's your job. Take these two guys in. They wanted to go in there. I don't know if we were supposed to go in there or not. I didn't know, but I was told we're take these two guys where they want to go. So I drove them in there.
Again, every question I ask, I'm just looking for your sincere answer, and I never want to put a thought in your mind. But I'm wondering if being there at age 19 and witnessing that aftermath, if that gives you any perspective on the use of nuclear weapons and whether that should ever happen again.
Well, those bombs, I think, weren't near what they've got today. And my feelings about that, if we ever get into a nuclear war, it could end this whole world. Because that is just a chain reaction explosion. And what if it hits the right combination that all these molecules start a chain reaction? Couldn't that go around the world? And we might be another sun.
And on the flip side of that, I've met a lot of guys, and I'm sure your case is just like theirs. I mean, you're in hand-to-hand combat in the jungles of the Philippines until they drop these bombs and end the war. And otherwise, you would have been probably making a different kind of landing in Japan with them firing back at you. Have you ever thought about that and felt like those bombs maybe saved your life?
Well, I think those bombs probably changed everybody's life in the world. Realization of it is if people could see that and see what was there, what was left. The only buildings there that stood up were the ones were concrete, and they were shells. There wasn't a window left. Doors and everything were. But the rest of the country in there, of course, they don't build like we do here, but I don't think our buildings would hold up under that shock wave that came from that. Everything was gone except steel or concrete.
Did it almost seem impossible that something like that could happen? I mean, did that blow your mind, for lack of a better phrase?
Well, looking at that, I don't see how any house, unless it was really made out of concrete, but they had concrete buildings, a regular house like we're sitting in right now, it wouldn't withstand that shock wave. No, these houses would be blown to smithereens. They might have the fires after, but you could see the ground over there where the, you know how ground turns kind of a reddish after a hot fire? That was all over there. Every place you looked, the ground looked like that.
You mentioned the Japanese prisoner who came and helped you guys with your Jeeps. And when I walked in, that's one of the first things you showed me, is you have a photo of yourself with this Japanese man. And you said something that I don't know if I've ever heard anyone else say to me. Because by the very nature of the assignment, there's usually not any survivors. You said that guy was a kamikaze pilot. Help me make sense of that.
Well, kamikaze pilots over there, they only gave them one-way gas because they drove the plane into their target. Well, he ran out of gas. He landed in the sea, and he was picked up by the Navy and made a prisoner till the end of the war. Now, I don't know how long he was a prisoner, but they took him and told him that they'd give him a job. So they sent him with us to help us repairing our Jeeps and our equipment. Well, at first, I couldn't speak Japanese, and he couldn't speak English, but we'd show him what to do, and they'd do it. Him and I got to liking each other, so I learned some Japanese, and he learned some English. And at one time, they didn't have a lot to eat, so I'd get him some of our chow, and he told me after he tried to eat it, he says he couldn't eat it, it would make him sick. We fiddled around with that for a while. He says, finally explained to me, just get me some rice. And they ate rice three meals a day over there.
Do you remember his name?
Hiroyuki Tamaguchi.
And I'm guessing, I mean, if you have a couple pictures of him on your mantle over here, that those have to be some good memories to look at that picture. What do you think about when you look at that photo of him from 73 years ago?
Well, he wanted me to get him to come to this country, but there was no way I could do it. And I often wonder what happened to him. The Japanese people, as far as one-on-one, they were good people. I got along with them fine.
Well, yeah, and here again, I mean, you're still a teenager. You didn't turn 20. I guess you probably turned 20 while you were hanging out with him in December of 45. But you said you were gung-ho to sign up because you wanted to go back and get them back for what they did to America. How much did it maybe change or soften your perspective to have that one-on-one time with him?
Well, you know, when I first got there, I didn't want to, you know, go after him because the war was over. I just wondered if they, and I guess they knew, because when we first landed there, the people were gone. There was nobody but policemen standing on corners. But it wasn't very long that we got along. I didn't feel I had anything against them anymore. You know, they weren't trying to fight us. We weren't trying to fight them. And for the most part, I got along real good with them. A lot of things I didn't understand, but I was privileged through him to meet some of the other people. I couldn't speak to them, but I went into their houses and saw how they lived. One thing I'll say about the Japanese, they have about the cleanest houses you ever wanted to see. And their houses are made out of wooden paper.
Was he about the same age as you, or do you think he was older or younger?
He was about my age, maybe a little younger. I'm not sure, but I never did ask him his age.
So it's not impossible that he could still be alive in Japan or elsewhere. If you knew that he was still around and you had a chance to say something to him 70-plus years later, what do you think you'd say to him?
Boy, I don't know, because he was a good friend. He helped us, you know, everything we asked him to do. And if anybody done anything wrong, any one of the other Japanese, they were pretty harsh on their own people. Now, he was a sergeant. I was a sergeant. They call a sergeant a gunzo. If one of the other fellows that we had working for us would do anything wrong, boy, he'd jump on them so fast. They'd stand up in front of him. What he was telling them, I don't know, but they'd stand like they were at attention. And if they didn't give him the right answer, he slapped them.
Was it hard for you? When you came back home, was it hard to adjust to being a civilian again?
At the beginning, yeah, it was. I didn't know if I was going to treat people right or not.
Well, I don't want to leave anything important out. So if there's anything else that, you know, that you want to share, feel free. But I do want to make sure I say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for telling us a unique story that only you could tell us. Is there something, as you look back on your service in World War II, that you would say you're most proud of or most appreciative of now?
Well, In a way, I would have liked to go back to Japan, but I got married and raised a family, but I learned to speak a little bit of the language. I can count in it. Ichi-ni san-si go roko hichi hachi kuju. So I had a good time over there. I went out and I sent my mother a silk obi and a kimono. And when I went to buy this, you go to their house, and it's usually the man of the house will sell these silk objects that the women of the house make. Their way of dealing is so much different than ours, because they think you're odd if he tells you a price he wants on something, you pay it and leave. He wants you to come back two or three times. You drink a little sake with him, and you'll finally buy it for probably half of what he asked. But that's the way they are. I got along good over there. I really got along good.
Well, you just mentioned your mother, and made me wonder what it was like coming home and seeing her again, because her first husband had died because of being gassed in World War I, and now she's had a son out there and probably more dangerous situations than even she realized. So what was that homecoming like for you?
My mother and I was a bit spoiled, let's face it. We lived with my grandfather and grandmother, so it was their house. My mother really, in a way, she had some things to say to raise me, but the boss man of the house was my grandfather.
Well, I got one more question for you. You know, you mentioned earlier you don't understand what the kids today are doing on these phones that they carry around everywhere. Is there something you think they should understand about World War II and what you and 16 million other Americans in uniform and a whole country behind them back here, what you all accomplished?
Well, I don't think they teach history in high school anymore. I don't know. And I wonder what all they really teach, because I've taken three of my great-grandsons and I gave them a little problem that they should have been able to figure out real easy, and none of them could. Now, these are kids that, two of them were already out of high school. One of them was still in high school. But they couldn't mathematically figure out something. They can figure it out by using these Kindles, but they got to know how to use that. They can't do it in their head or with paper and pencil. And I wonder what happens when the lights go out. And what I asked them, I says, if you're driving down the highway at 60 miles an hour, how many feet do you cover in 1 second?
Well, so there's a test you can give yourself as you listen today, but we're about out of seconds. Don't forget to check out the photos and video of Mr. Harden online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.